only when our arms are sufficient without doubt can we be certain without doubt, that they will never have to be employed. And so when we had the crisis of the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc in October of 1962, the Soviet Union withdrew their missiles and the bombers from Cuba. Should exist, and this world really should be a better place when we turned it over to the next generation than when we inherited it from the last generation. And that's why with all of these other efforts that he made, with the test ban treaty, which is done with Avril Harris, is so important to him. And that's why he made such an effort. That's why he made such an effort, and so was committed to the young people, not only of the United States, but the young people of the world. And in all of these efforts, you were there, all of you. And when there were difficulties, you sustained it. When there were periods of crisis, you stood beside him. When there were periods of happiness, you laughed with him. And when there were periods of sorrow, you comforted him. I realize that as an individual, that we can't just look back, that we must look forward. When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, that when he shall die, take him and cut him out into the stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. But I realize, as an individual, and really,
my candidacy for for the presidency of the United States. I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies. I run because I am convinced that this country is on a perilous course, and because I have such strong feelings about what must be done, and I feel that I'm obliged to do all that I can.
I'm going to remain on as a United States Senator representing the state of New York, and I'm going to support the Democratic ticket in 1968 of President Johnson Hubert Humphrey.
Boo.
We have rebuked her ungodliness, and now the sun shines on Russia as on a country with which God is well pleased, whilst his wrath is heavy on us, and we don't know where to turn for comfort or approval. We have prided ourselves on our mastery in big business and its solid foundations in the knowledge of human nature, and now we are bankrupt.
Small bands of students are allowed to shut down great universities. Small groups of dissidents are allowed to shout down political candidates. Small cadres of professional protesters are allowed to jeopardize the peace efforts of the President of the United States. It's time to question the credentials of their leaders. And if in questioning we disturb a few people, I say it's time for them to be disturbed. And if in challenging we polarize the American people, I say it's time for a positive polarization.
I think it's obvious from the cameras here that I didn't come to discuss the ban on cyclamates or DDT. I have a subject I think is of great interest to the American people. Tonight I want to discuss the importance of the television medium to the American people. Monday night, a week ago, President Nixon delivered the most important address of his administration, one of the most important of our decade. His subject was Vietnam. My hope, as his, at that time, was to rally the American people, to see the conflict through to a lasting and just peace in the Pacific. For 32 minutes, he reasoned with a nation that has suffered almost a third of a million casualties in the longest war in its history. When the president completed his address, an address, incidentally, that he spent weeks in the preparation of, his words and policies were subjected to instant analysis and querulous criticism. The audience of 70 million Americans gathered to hear the President of the United States was inherited by a small band of network commentators and self-appointed analysts, the majority of whom expressed in one way or another their hostility to what he had to say. It was obvious that their minds were made up in advance. One commentator twice contradicted the president's statement about the exchange of correspondence with Ho Chi Minh. Another challenged the president's abilities as a politician. A third asserted that the president was following the Pentagon line. Others, by the expressions on their faces, the tone of their questions, and the sarcasm of their responses, made clear their sharp disapproval. To guarantee in advance that the president's plea for national unity would be challenged, one network trotted out Averell Harriman for the occasion. Throughout the president's address, he waited in the wings. When the president concluded, Mr. Harriman recited perfectly. All in all, Mr. Harriman offered a broad range of gratuitous advice, challenging and contradicting the policies outlined by the President of the United States. Where the President had issued a call for unity, Mr. Harriman was encouraging the country not to listen to him. A word about Mr. Harriman. For 10 months, he was America's chief negotiator at the Paris peace talks. a period in which the United States swapped some of the greatest military concessions in the history of warfare for an enemy agreement on the shape of the bargaining table. Like Coleridge's Ancient Mariner, Mr. Harriman seems to be under some heavy compulsion to justify his failures to anyone who will listen. And the networks have shown themselves willing to give him all the airtime he desires. Now, every American has a right to disagree with the President of the United States and to express publicly that disagreement. But the President of the United States has a right to communicate directly with the people who elected him. And the people of this country have the right to make up their own minds and form their own opinions about a presidential address without having the president's words and thoughts characterized through the prejudices of hostile critics before they can even be digested. When Winston Churchill rallied public opinion to stay the course against Hitler's Germany, he didn't have to contend with a gaggle of commentators raising doubts about whether he was reading public opinion right or whether Britain had the stamina to see the war through. When President Kennedy rallied the nation in the Cuban Missile Crisis, his address to the people was not chewed over by a round table of critics who disparaged the course of action he'd asked America to follow. The purpose of my remarks tonight is to focus your attention on this little group of men who not only enjoy a right of instant rebuttal to every presidential address, but more importantly, wield a free hand in selecting, presenting, and interpreting the great issues in our nation. Now, how is this network news determined? A small group of men, numbering perhaps no more than a dozen anchormen, commentators, and executive producers, settle upon the 20 minutes or so of film and commentary that's to reach the public. This selection is made from the 90 to 180 minutes that may be available. Their powers of choice are broad. They decide what 40 to 50 million Americans will learn of the day's events in the nation and in the world. We cannot measure this power and influence by the traditional democratic standards, for these men can create national issues overnight. They can make or break, by their coverage and commentary, a moratorium on the war. They can elevate men from obscurity to national prominence within a week. They can reward some politicians with national exposure and ignore others. For millions of Americans, the network reporter who covers a continuing issue, like the ABM or civil rights, becomes, in effect, the presiding judge in a national trial by jury. It must be recognized that the networks have made important contributions to the national knowledge. Through news, documentaries, and specials, they have often used their power constructively and creatively to awaken the public conscience to critical problems. The networks made hunger and black lung disease national issues overnight. The TV networks have done what no other medium could have done in terms of dramatizing the horrors of war. The networks have tackled our most difficult social problems with a directness and an immediacy that's the gift of their medium. They focused the nation's attention on its environmental abuses, on pollution in the Great Lakes, and the threatened ecology of the Everglades. But it was also the networks that elevated Stokely Carmichael and George Lincoln Rockwell from obscurity to national prominence, nor is their power confined to the substantive. A raised eyebrow, an inflection of the voice, a caustic remark dropped in the middle of a broadcast can raise doubts in a million minds about the veracity of a public official or the wisdom of a government policy. One federal communications commissioner considers the powers of the networks equal to that of local, state, and federal governments all combined. Certainly, it represents a concentration of power over American public opinion unknown in history. The American people would rightly not tolerate this concentration of power in government. Is it not fair and relevant to question its concentration in the hands of a tiny, enclosed fraternity of privileged men elected by no one and enjoying a monopoly sanctioned and licensed by government? The views of a majority of this fraternity do not, and I repeat, not represent the views of America. Make myself perfectly clear. I'm not asking for government censorship or any other kind of censorship. I'm asking whether a form of censorship already exists when the news that 40 million Americans receive each night is determined by a handful of men responsible only to their corporate employers and is filtered through a handful of commentators who admit to their own set of biases. Now it's argued that this power presents no danger in the hands of those who have used it responsibly. But as to whether or not the networks have abused the power they enjoy, let us call as our first witness former Vice President Humphrey and the city of Chicago. According to Theodore White, television's intercutting of the film from the streets of Chicago with the current proceedings on the floor of the convention created the most striking and false political picture of 1968. The nomination of a man for the American presidency by the brutality and violence of merciless police. If we are to believe a recent report of the House of Representatives Commerce Committee, then television's presentation of the violence in the streets worked an injustice on the reputation of the Chicago police. According to the committee findings, one network in particular presented, and I quote, a one-sided picture which in large measure exonerates the demonstrators and protesters. Film of provocations of police that was available never saw the light of day, while the film of the police response, which the protesters provoked, was shown to millions. Gresham's Law seems to be operating in the network news. Bad news drives out good news. The irrational is more controversial than the rational. Concurrence can no longer compete with dissent. 1 minute of Eldridge Cleaver is worth 10 minutes of Roy Wilkins. The labor crisis settled at the negotiating table is nothing compared to the confrontation that results in a strike, or better yet, violence along the picket lines. Normality has become the nemesis of the network news. Now, the upshot of all this controversy is that a narrow and distorted picture of America often emerges from the televised news. A single dramatic piece of the mosaic becomes, in the minds of millions, the entire picture. The American who relies upon television for his news might conclude that the majority of American students are embittered radicals, that the majority of black Americans feel no regard for their country, that violence and lawlessness are the rule rather than the exception on the American campus. We know that none of these conclusions is true. Perhaps the place to start looking for a credibility gap is not in the offices of the government in Washington, but in the studios of the networks in New York. In certain intellectual and political circles, there is an opinion that America should isolate itself from world affairs. To my mind, this is another sign of illness. It demands that a vigorous, powerful nation withdraw from the world scene and commit its full resources to solving its internal problems. We should, according to this point of view, not get involved abroad. But this misses what is the most elementary and most obvious fact in our times. We are involved. If that be the burden of power, then I suggest we make the most of it. The rank and file Democrat in this country does not share the philosophy of permissiveness expressed by the best publicized moral and intellectual leaders of our society. He reads with disgust all the rave reviews the press gives to the latest dirty movie or dirty book. He's starting to resent the use of his children as guinea pigs in the latest social experiment of some way-out educator who sends his own children to distant private schools.
really doesn't want to hear any more from the bleeding hearts who tell him to feel sorry for the criminals who have made his city unfit and unsafe for his family. He's had a belly full of politicians who fawn over young radicals who have no manners and less sense. In short, he's just a little bit fed up with the limousine liberals running his party, and he's fed up with the whole gang. To those Democrats who've had enough of that kind of leadership, I say, come on over to our side. There's lots of room in the end. Senator Fulbright said some months ago that if the Vietnam War went on much longer, the best of our young people would be in Canada. I'd just as soon let Senator Fulbright go prospecting for his future party leaders in the deserters' dens of Canada and Sweden. We Republicans will look elsewhere. Indeed, as for these deserters, malcontents, radicals, incendiaries, the civil and the uncivil disobedience among our young, SDS, PLP, Weatherman 1, Weatherman 2, the Revolutionary Action Movement, Panthers, Lions, Hippies, Yippies, Tigers alike, I'd rather swap the whole damn zoo for a single platoon of the kind of young Americans I saw in Vietnam. The true responsibility for these aberrations and the nurturing of arrogance and contempt for constitutional authority rests not with the young people on the campuses, but with those who so miserably fail to guide them. I can well understand the attitude of a majority of the student body at Yale University when most of the Yale faculty voted to endorse a strike in support of members of an organization dedicated to criminal violence, anarchy, and the destruction of the United States of America. And when the president of that respected university describes the election of a president of the United States by the people of the United States as a hucksterized process under which they could not expect much better, whichever package was bought or sold, it's clearly time for the alumni of that fine old college to demand that it be headed by a more mature and responsible person. Now, this speech was prepared before the national scene became so tense. And some of you who are students of my rhetoric will be surprised to know that I did not author these controversial paragraphs. They have been released, and I will not apologize for them. The content of them is in accordance with my thinking, but the rhetoric is not mine. The president said tonight, in talking about what he was going to do about what some of my critics call the exacerbating effect I may have on the community, I heard the president say tonight, in saying that he would not muzzle me, and I haven't heard from him. I haven't talked to him. The only message I got was relayed by Mr. Haldeman today when he told me that the president wanted to be certain that I knew that he had made no criticism or made no attempts to suppress what I wanted to say. But the president did say this. He said, when the situation is hot, I would hope that the people on my team will profit by my advice and know that that's the time that the rhetoric should become cool. And even though, as I've said, this speech has been distributed in total, if my abandonment of the first two pages of this speech in some small way will help to cool the very volatile situation in the United States, I'm going to do it. And I hope in this way that all of those who are involved in the tremendous wave wave of emotion that's sweeping the country at the present time and manifested itself in the various demonstrations, will exercise the kind of self-restraint that I, through the example of one of the greatest presidents of the United States, am going to impose on myself this evening. Lately, you've been exposed, ladies and gentlemen, to a great amount of public comment about vice presidential rhetoric and how I should cool it. Now, the president's getting this advice almost daily from many quarters, some of them inside the government. But mostly it's come from persons who have been, to some extent, in the target area of my remarks. Nowhere is the complaint louder than in the columns and editorials of the liberal news media in this country. As I said in jest, but I mean it very sincerely, the president has refused to curb my statements on behalf of this administration's policies or tell me what words to use or what tone to use in my speeches. And on my part, I have refused to cool it, to use the vernacular, until those self-righteous people lower their voices a few decibels. The great question for all of us this fall is becoming ever clearer. Will America be led by a president elected by a majority of the American people, or will we be intimidated and blackmailed into following the path dictated by a disruptive, radical, and militant minority, the pampered prodigies of the radical liberals in the United States Senate? Those radical liberals have hatched their little chicks, and now they're coming home to roost. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in my view, this fall, any candidate of any party who voices radical sentiments or who courts or enjoys the support of radical elements ought to be voted out of office by the American people. It's just too dangerous. And that brings me to my target for tonight, the professional pessimist. Now, I speak of a man whose theme song is "Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud." In the past, he's been called the prophet of gloom and doom, the troubadour of trouble, the disciple of despair. The professional pessimist has always been with us, and on the great movements of American history, he's always been wrong. Today, he's out of office and out of sorts. In the United States today, we have more than our share of the nattering nabobs of negativism. Actually, they've formed their own 4-H club. The hopeless, hysterical hypochondriacs of history. Now, this refusal to admit that America is on the right path colors everything the professional pessimists say and do. To our allies, they propose a policy of the double cross. Before our enemies, they preen in blatant obsequiousness. The men who smack their lips over any American setback in the world are also great prognosticators here at home. Professional pessimists have been wrong about inflation, they've been wrong about recession, wrong about Vietnamization, wrong about disorder, wrong about arms control, wrong about crime, wrong about the strength of the American character. And some of these wrongos have the colossal gall to ask you to elect them again. Radical liberal will not get exercised over the presence of hardcore pornography at the corner drugstore, but for heaven's sake, don't let him catch your son praying in the public schools. The
radical liberal will not hesitate to demand the immediate use of the 82nd Airborne to integrate the schools of a southern state. But he will buy his house as far out in the suburbs. So far, you have to take the Metro liner to get there. Radical liberal will want your child bussed clear across town to meet someone's notion of proper racial balance, but his own kids will be off to Pensy Prep.
Sometimes it appears that we're reaching a period when our senses and our minds will no longer respond to moderate stimulation. We seem to be approaching an age of the gross. Persuasion through speeches and books is too often discarded for disruptive demonstrations aimed at bludgeoning the unconvinced into action. The young, and by this I don't mean by any stretch of the imagination all the young, but I'm talking about those who claim to speak for the young, at the zenith of physical power and sensitivity, overwhelm themselves with drugs and artificial stimulants. Subtlety is lost, and fine distinctions based on acute reasoning are carelessly ignored in a headlong jump to a predetermined conclusion. Life is visceral rather than intellectual, and the most visceral practitioners of life are those who characterize themselves as intellectuals. Truth is to them revealed rather than logically proved. And the principal infatuations of today revolve around the social sciences, those subjects which can accommodate any opinion and about which the most reckless conjecture cannot be discredited. Education is being redefined at the demand of the uneducated to suit the ideas of the uneducated. The student now goes to college to proclaim rather than to learn. The lessons of the past are ignored and obliterated in a contemporary antagonism known as the generation gap. A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by an effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals.
Protest demonstrations have taken place by workers whose trade union rights have been betrayed, by Catholics whose freedom of expression has been circumscribed, by professional men. Christian right.
Communism is abhorrent. Communism is strangulation for the individual and death for the soul. Americans who have surrendered to this misbegotten idol have surrendered their right to our trust. And there can be no secure place for them in our public life.
Right, sir, let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does.
In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
You're in the court of world opinion right now, and you can answer yes or no. You have denied that they exist. I want to know if I have understood you correctly.
Sir, would you please continue your statement? You will have your answer in due course.
Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in due course.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision. And I'm also prepared to present the evidence in this room.
We both flew down from Chicago yesterday afternoon aboard one of the giant new 21-passenger flagships of American Airlines. It took us only 3 hours, 55 minutes to fly nonstop from Chicago to New York. When we landed at Newark, we found another flagship of American Airlines waiting to take us to Lakehurst with our equipment when we were ready to go. And incidentally, American Airlines is the only airline in the United States which makes connections with the Hindenburg. The Hindenburg left Frankfurt, Germany, Tuesday evening, rather, at 7:30 their time. And for better than 2.5 days, they've been speeding through the skies over miles and miles of water here to America. Now they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside. So as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, and what a great sight it is. A thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motors just roared, their propellers fighting into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. Now, a field that we thought active when we first arrived has turned into a moving mass of cooperative action. The landing crews have rushed to the posts and spots, and orders are being passed along, and last-minute preparations are being completed for the moment we have waited for so long. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty, mighty proud of a place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows looking down at the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from...
It's burst into flames. Get it started. Get it started. It's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring mast. And all the folks between that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's crashing. 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around here. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people as friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honest, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I've sort of recovered from the terrific explosion and the terrific crash that occurred just as it was being pulled down to the mooring mast. The terrible amount of hydrogen gas in it just caused the tail surface broke into flame first. Then there was a terrific explosion, and that followed by the burning of the nose and the crashing nose into the ground, and everybody tearing back at breakneck speed to get out from underneath it because it was over the people at the time it burst into flames. Now, whether it fell on the people who were witnessing it, we do not know. But as it exploded, they raced back. And now it's smoking, a terrific black smoke floating up into the sky. The flames are still leaping maybe 30, 40 feet from the ground, the entire 811 feet length of it. They're frantically calling for ambulances and things. The wires are being humming with activity. And I've lost my breath several times during this exciting moment here. Will you pardon me just a moment? I'm not going to stop talking. I'm just going to swallow several times until I can keep on. I should imagine that the nose is not more than 500 feet or maybe 700 feet from the mooring mast. They have dropped two ropes, and whether or not
some spark or something set it on fire, we don't know, or whether something pulled loose on the inside of the ship causing a spark and causing it to explode in the tail surface. But everything crashed to the ground and there's not a possible chance of anybody being saved. I wish I could stop in just a moment and see if I can get my breath again. And Charlie, if you'll fade it out just a minute, I'll come back with more description, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I raced down to the burning ship, and just as I walked up to the ship, over climbed over the picket line, I met a man coming out dazed. He couldn't find his way. I grabbed a hold of him. It's Philip Mangone. Philip Mangone, A-N-G-O-N-E, of New York. Philip Mangone, he's burned terribly in the hands, and he's burned terribly in the face. His eyebrows and all his hair is burned off, but he's walking and talking plainly and distinctly, and he told me he jumped. He jumped with other passengers. Now, there's a Mr. Spay. It sounds like Spay. We're not sure of it. And he also got out. Now, it is my sincere hope the majority of the passengers jumped when it came close to the ground, according to what Mr. Mangone told me. He says, thank God he jumped, and we say thank God for him also.
Although my visit, which comes as a result of the invitation extended to me by the British government and by Mr. Winston Churchill personally, has not formally the character of an official visit, I am nevertheless profoundly convinced that it will greatly contribute to the further strengthening of the friendship, mutual understanding, and collaboration between our two nations.
Marshal Tito, would you like to take this opportunity when you are appearing before the people of America to give them any special message?
Yes, I will take this opportunity to send my greetings to America's people, to all them in America who understand our difficulties, who have sympathy for free and independent Yugoslavia.
Soviet imperialism has replaced Nazi imperialism as a threat to the peace of the world. Stalin will not stop of his own volition. He can only be stopped.
I can conceive of a national destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibilities of tomorrow. Behold a republic resting securely upon the mountain of eternal truth. A republic applying in practice and proclaiming to the world the self-evident propositions that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with inalienable rights, that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Behold a republic in which civil and religious liberty stimulate all to earnest endeavor, and in which the law restrains every hand uplifted for a neighbor's injury. A republic in which every citizen is a sovereign, but in which no one cares to wear a crown. Behold a republic standing erect while empires all around are bowed beneath the weight of their own armaments. A republic whose flag is love, while other flags are only fear. Behold a republic increasing in population, in wealth, in strength, and in influence, solving the problems of civilization and facing the coming of a universal brotherhood. A republic which shakes thrones and dissolves aristocracies by its silent example and gives light and inspiration to those who sit in darkness. Behold a republic gradually but surely becoming a supreme moral factor in the world's progress and the accepted arbiter of the world's disputes. A republic whose history, like the path of the just, is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day.
I am not, and never have been, a member of the Communist Party.
The cry of the French at Verdun, they shall not pass, and the cheer of our own men in the Argonne, we shall go through, these were essential glory. Yet they are incomplete. To them, we must write the binding finish, it shall not occur again. For America demands that the crime of war shall cease.
I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Velocity light, 8 amps down, 220 feet, 15 forward, 11 forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet, 4.5 down, 5.5 down, 160, 6.5 down, 5.5 down, 9 forward, good, 120 feet. 8 down, 9 forward. 5%. How many bites? 875 feet. They're looking good, down a half. 6 forward.
60 seconds.
Lights on. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. 30 feet down 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Great shadow. 4 forward. 4 forward. Drifting to the right a little. Down a half.
30 seconds.
Forward just. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Roger, we're about to get both of you in the field of view of the camera from there.
Roger, we're about to get both of you in the field of view of the camera from there.
Neil and Buzz, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you. Over.
That would be an honor.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out.
Neil and Buzz, I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House, and this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you've done. For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives, and for people all over the world, I am sure they too join with the in recognizing what an immense feat this is. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world. And as you talk to us from the Sea of Tranquility, it inspires us to redouble our efforts to bring peace and tranquility to Earth. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, people on this earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done. And one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth.
Thank you, Mr. President.
It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here representing not only the United States, but of peace of all nations, and with interest and a curiosity and with a vision for the future. Honor for us to be able to participate here today.
And thank you very much, and I look forward, all of us look forward to seeing you on the Hornet on Thursday.
Look forward to that very much, sir.
Houston, we've had a problem.
15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8. Ignition sequence has started. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit and we have liftoff at 2:13. The Saturn V building up to 7.6 million pounds of thrust, and it has cleared the tower.
You can never whip these birds if you don't keep you and them separate. You've got to keep the white and the black separate. Let the law enforcement agencies, that's what you got them hired for, and the governor of the state of Alabama handle this thing. Now, George asked me to ask you to do that. Do him one favor. Tell your friends when you leave here between now and Tuesday, don't go up there. Leave it alone. They're going to handle this situation. Just leave it alone. You know, those Kennedys up there in Washington, that little old Bobby Sox and his brother, the president, they'd give anything in the world if we had some trouble here. If we don't have any trouble, we can beat them at their own game.
They have said is that I have no ambition at all. I feel myself sincerely. I don't ambition power, money, nothing, only to serve my country.
Good.
I have not always been wrong about the future of events, and if you will permit me, I shall inscribe some of these words as my testament, because I should like to be held accountable for them in years which I shall not see. We have got a tremendous task before us, rushing upon us with all the speed of crisis. We have won the great war. Let us win the great peace.
I have never accepted what many people have kindly said, namely, that I inspired the nation. Their will was resolute and remorseless, and yet it proved unconquerable. It fell to me to express it, and if I found the right words, you must remember that I have always earned my living by my pen and by my tongue. It was the nation and the race dwelling all round the globe that had the lion's heart. I had the luck to be called upon to give the roar.
Reminded an old man. It is true that all the daydreams of my youth have been accomplished. I have no personal advantage to gain by undertaking once more the hard and grim duty of leading Britain and her empire through and out of her new and formidable crisis. But while God gives me the strength and the people show me their goodwill, it is my duty to try, and try I will.
Writing a book is an adventure. To begin with, it is a toy and an amusement, and then it becomes a mistress, and then it becomes a master. And then he becomes a tyrant. And the last phase is that just as you are about to be reconciled to your servitude, you kill the monster and fling him about to the public. I must not conceal from you tonight the truth as I see it. It is certain that Europe would have been communized like Czechoslovakia and London under bombardment some time ago, but for the deterrent of the atomic bomb in the hands of the United States. The situation has been well described by distinguished Americans as the Cold War. And the question is asked, are we winning the Cold War? We seek nothing from Russia but goodwill and fair play. If, however, there is to be a war of nerves, let us make sure that our nerves are strong. We must build a kind of United States of Europe.
But I must give you a warning. Time may be short. If we are to form the United States of Europe, or whatever name it may take, we must begin now.
I'm now going to say something that will astonish you.
the first step in the recreation of the European family must be a partnership between France and Germany.
I stand before you today, the representative of a family in grief, in a country in mourning, before a world in shock. We are all united, not only in our desire to pay our respects to Diana, but rather in our need to do so. For such was her extraordinary appeal that the tens of millions of people taking part in this service all over the world via television and radio, who never actually met her, feel that they too lost someone close to them in the early hours of Sunday morning. It is a more remarkable tribute to Diana than I can ever hope to offer her today. Diana was the very essence of compassion, of duty, of style, of beauty. All over the world, she was a symbol of selfless humanity, a standard bearer for the rights of the truly downtrodden, a very British girl who transcended nationality, someone with a natural nobility who was classless, and who proved in the last year that she needed no royal title to continue to generate her particular brand of magic. Today is our chance to say thank you for the way you brightened our lives, even though God granted you but half a life. We will all feel cheated always that you were taken from us so young, and yet we must learn to be grateful that you came along at all. Only now you are gone do we truly appreciate what we are now without, and we want you to know that life without you is very, very difficult. We have all despaired at our loss over the past week, and only the strength of the message you gave us through your years of giving has afforded us the strength to move forward. There is a temptation to rush to canonize your memory. There is no need to do so. You stand tall enough as a human being of unique qualities, not need to be seen as a saint. Indeed, to sanctify your memory would be to miss out on the very core of your being, your wonderfully missed